call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes from February 16, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Frazier moves the minutes from February 16, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes for February 16, 2023 are approved. Members, the first bill we have on our agenda today is a Representative Curran bill. It's House File 1523. And I understand that the motion is that House File 1523 be recommended to be placed on the General Register, Representative Curran.
Yes, that is my motion.
All right, great. Your bill is before us. I don't see that we have any amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Chair and members. So this is a pretty simple bill. What we're realistically looking at is a group of licensed peace officers in Minnesota who are charged with apprehending fugitives. And currently, the way that the statute language reads, it actually limits the scope of their duties as law enforcement officers when they're acting in this role. So this piece of legislation would just remove that barrier so that they can continue to do the work that they're licensed for in their capacity on the Fugitive Apprehension Unit.
All right, great. And looks like you have a testifier at the table. I'm assuming you're Mark Kotterick?
Yes, I am.
All right, please go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members, for having me here today to speak in need of 1523 in our legislative framework. I am Mark Kotterick, the Assistant Director of the Office of Special Investigations Fugitive Apprehension Unit for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. The Minnesota Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit was created by the legislator in 2000. Minnesota Statute 241.025, Subdivision 1 gave the Commissioner of Corrections authority to have the DOC Fugitive Apprehension Unit officers perform duties necessary to make statewide arrests by the authority of the agency. But the authority of the agency is limited to the arrest of DOC discretionary and statutory release violators and DOC facility escapees. The unit is made up of 13 post-certified peace officers who are highly trained in fugitive apprehensions and partner with local, county, state, and federal law enforcement partners daily to do its work. For your awareness, the governor's budget recommendation for the Department of Corrections includes funding to increase the investigations and staffing capacity of the Fugitive Apprehension Unit, something I understand you will consider at a later time. In the bill before you today, HF 1523, DOC peace officers are authorized to carry out general law enforcement duties at the request of law enforcement agency of jurisdiction. Investigate criminal offenses in agency-operated correctional facilities and surrounding properties, and assist other law enforcement agencies upon request. The bill also permits a local law enforcement agency to authorize our officers to assume the subsequent investigation of a crime, should the primary jurisdiction choose so. The legal framework envisioned by this bill is similar to the statute used by the Metro Transit officers. It grants our officers general law enforcement authority during the course of their duties as defined in statute and while assisting other law enforcement agencies. Currently, as stated by our commissioner in the past, our unit is unable to assist or provide aid to local law enforcement jurisdictions in keeping our community safe. There are three considerations relevant to this bill that I'd like to address today. First, the bill proposes that our officers may, on request, assist law enforcement by way of example. When we hear that a significant activity, active shooter, robbery in progress, hostage situation, or an officer requesting assistance has happened in a community, we currently cannot respond, even if we're only a block away. This bill allows us to provide aid to local law enforcement to address in developing situations if requested. Second, the bill clarifies that our officers have general law enforcement duties. DOC officers are always in communities while investigating individuals who have absconded, so your prison release violators. If a domestic call were to come out while we were conducting our investigation, even if a DOC officer's response is the fastest response and can actually intervene in a situation, we cannot do so today according to today's statute. DOC officers are one of the only licensed officers limited to this single purpose of the fugitive arrest. Third, this bill makes sense that what happens in our facilities does not put a strain on local resources. When crimes are committed inside our facilities, such as violations of orders of protection, harassment by a person in custody, narcotics introduction, or assaults in Minnesota State correctional facilities, It can be involved for local law enforcement agencies to investigate occurrences in our facilities which impact in their communities or take away law enforcement time from the communities. Our officers are uniquely positioned to exercise law enforcement duties when investigating general cases in a way that can support local jurisdictions and thereby conserve their resources. I'll close by noting that the officers, myself included, come from years of previous experience working as peace officers without restrictions to statutes and laws taught us through the licensing process. We come from departments such as Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, Maplewood Police Department, Wright County Sheriff's Office, Waseca Police Department, Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, to name a few. By supporting this legislative change to bring the DOC officers in line with all other law enforcement officers in the state, you're allowing these talented, experienced, veteran officers to work and contribute to an overall safer Minnesota community. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Do we have other testifiers, Representative Curran? Are you aware of it? Okay. Anyone from the audience who wishes to testify to this? All right. I'm not seeing anybody, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Novotny.
I'll just speak to the bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. Thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Curran. It's a bill I spoke to and strongly encouraged with the language that we had last session, and glad we can push this through from the standpoint that it keeps the investigations clean, not bringing in other officers and involving them in the situation when they come across evidence during the course of their investigations and duties, and just seems like a common sense good bill. Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Curran.
I don't think I could have said that better. It's absolutely a common sense, clean bill, and I appreciate the support.
All right. Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 1523 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Thanks again for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 1321. It is a Representative Tabke bill. We're going to be laying over this bill, so I will move to lay over House File 1321. And Representative Tabke, I do notice that you have an author's amendment. I believe it's a DE1. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Mueller.
All right. Would you like to move your DE1 amendment?
Yes, please.
And I think because it's a DE, it probably doesn't make sense to explain the amendment. So instead, let's just move to a vote on the DE amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Tabke, go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended, please.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. So the DE was just some technical corrections from the original bill and some smaller other things as well. So the what we have today before us is a bill from Department of Corrections that Chair Mariani had in the past. And with this is House File 1321 to create an indeterminate sentence release board to make decisions on parole. So Minnesota is one of only four states in the nation that does not have a panel or a board to complete these paroles. And so with this, what this does is gives the power to grant paroles for life sentences and other things to a parole board, as opposed to just having it with the guy sitting to my left here. So with that, Madam Chair, the commissioner is here and would like to make some comments on the bill.
Thank you. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Paul Schnell, Commissioner at the Department of Corrections. I want to thank you, Representative Tappy, for being willing to bring this bill forward. It is, as mentioned, it is not new, but I recognize that we have new members, and for those in the public who would benefit from some background and context. I'll start by giving some background on the current systems for determining parole in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota, as I've mentioned before, is a determinant sentencing state, meaning that we know what that sentence will be. However, since 1980, those sentenced to life with the possibility of parole must appear before the Commissioner of Corrections for a life sentence review hearing. We begin seeing these folks at 3 years prior to their minimum term of confinement. When the court sentences someone to life, there are really two options: a life without the possibility of parole, or life with the possibility of parole. for those sentenced to life with the possibility of parole. The law is clear that they must serve a mandatory minimum 30 years in today's law, and then have the opportunity to review under a process and criteria codified in statute and rule for the possibility of parole release. Minnesota has approximately 600 people serving life sentences in our state. 150 of those people are serving life without the possibility of parole sentences. As Representative Tapke mentioned, Minnesota is one of only four states where a single person makes these parole decisions. There are many safeguards in place in our law and in the administrative rules that allow for and require careful review of release decisions where victims are consulted, a public safety risk is assessed, and full psychological evaluations are done along with the review of their prison adjustment. And statutorily, these decisions have to be made. However, the current structure makes it challenging to ensure consistency and objectivity in the parole decision-making process. There are significant differences that often come with the approach and interpretation of laws governing life sentences. To illustrate the differences and challenges, we looked at and analyzed data that speaks to the high level of variation in the single-person decision-making approach. Over a 20-year period, three commissioners reviewed people for parole. 63% of the people granted parole were granted parole by just two commissioners. This is not an indictment of any administration, but instead highlights the challenges presented when making these difficult decisions for a single decision maker. HF 1321, before you establishes this indeterminate sentence release board, ISRB, made up of a panel of five qualified individuals, four which would be appointed by the governor from recommendations that are made by each of the majority and minority leaders of the House and the Senate, and the Commissioner of Corrections serves as the fifth member and chair. The bill simply expands who conducts the reviews and makes release decisions, not who should be eligible for a review and possible release. The bill creates this panel of experts with the right qualifications selected by leadership of legislative branch and the governor to do what is currently the sole responsibility of the commissioner. We believe that shared transparent decision-making in these really difficult situations should be made in the most obvious way possible and in accordance with Minnesota law and in a way that promotes fair and balanced approach. A panel approach to decision-making will reduce bias, increase diversity of perspective, and strengthen understanding of correctional policy, resulting in more fair and equitable decision-making. I thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to stand for any questions you or the members may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I don't believe we have any other testifiers signed up, but are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any. I'm also told by nonpartisan staff that I screwed up with how we did the DE voting. And so what we need to do is basically look at the DE again, consider the amendments that have been offered to the DE, and then vote again on those amendments and then on the DE. So I'm going to do my best to do what we're supposed to do here. So first we need to, I need to move to reconsider adoption of the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. So now we've got the DE1 in front of us again. And now we're going to move to the amendments to the DE, and I believe those are the A4 and the A5. So first is the A4 amendment, and I think Representative Novotny, that's your amendment. Representative Whitty.
Yep.
That's yours. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hoping to make this bill a little better with this amendment. The A4 amendment replaces the four governor appointees on the intermittent sentence and release board. The bill has the governor make appointments with recommendations made by the House and Senate Democrat and Republican caucuses. The A4 instead has the governor appoint four retired district court judges, court of appeals judges, or Supreme Court justices to the board. This amendment would take politics out of the four governor-appointed members in the release process, and the judges are nonpartisan. I think that's what Commissioner Schnell talked about in the bill. Retired judges have had a career of making sentencing and release decisions. Retired judges are far more adept at determining who should be granted release and who should be kept in prison. I ask for your support of the A4 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Woody. Representative Tabke to the A4.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I guess that I should have encouraged everyone to vote against reconsidering the DE, is what I'm hearing. No, thank you very much, Representative, for this, and I appreciate where you're coming from with it, but we would like to move forward with continuing with the four appointed by the governor, because the pool of applicants that are potential for this with your amendment are very small, and we want to keep that open. If there are problems in the future, absolutely willing and always interested to talk about things as they go forward, but this would very severely, significantly limit the pool of applicants that would be available for the parole board, and so we'd like to continue with the language, so I encourage a no vote.
Further discussion to the A4 amendment? Representative Russell.
I'm just thinking, Representative Tabke, you made a good point there that it would be very limited, but it would be limited to those who would best be suited to look at this stuff objectively and make a very wise and good decision as far as public safety goes. So, I mean, I appreciate your point, but I don't, I guess I really would rather see somebody who's got some good experience in this field making these decisions rather than opening it up to such a broad field as to having people that, you know, might not have quite a depth of background as far as dealing with this type of stuff.
Any comment, Representative Tacky?
No.
Okay, and I'll just note that the bill as written does, or the DES written does, have a number of qualifications that the folks that would be on this board are supposed to have. Further discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anticipating that this is going to get voted down, I would just suggest to the author considering some sort of change in language in like 2.1 or 2.2 that calls for a diversity of experience. So it lists off all those different categories of experience, criminal justice, community corrections, behavioral health, etc. I assume the intention isn't to have a board that has five people on it that all are all in one of those categories. Maybe some language to the effect of make a best effort to try to diversify that experience can at least get to the effect of what we're trying to do here. Thank you.
Representative Pack, can you follow up to that?
No, the point well taken. This is getting laid over, so there's plenty of time to work on language.
Great. Closing remarks to your A4, Representative Woody.
No, I appreciate you taking the amendment. I think it would take the politics out of it and put people that do have the experience to hear it. So I appreciate you taking and listening to the amendment.
All right. All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The A4 amendment is not adopted. Next, we have the A5 amendment. Who's offering that? Representative Ingen to the A5.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So the A5 amendment, it replaces the requirement that just a simple majority of a quorum present can discharge a felon from a sentence. Here in Minnesota, we require the pardon board to find pardons acceptable only if it's through unanimous vote. We also require any criminal conviction to be the result of a unanimous jury finding under Rule 26.01, Subdivision 5. So as Representative Tabke's bill currently sits, without this amendment, three people appointed by the governor with these qualifications, as we just went over, they are able to act in a way that other boards, members, juries, our criminal justice system as a whole can't. And so this just simply fixes that by saying that unanimous approval is needed. So I ask for member support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tabke to the A5.
Thank you, Representative Engen. So, and Chair Mueller. So with this as well, I will recommend a no vote on this because what moving this to a unanimous vote puts a very, very high level of finality and moving forward on anything being able to be done by the parole board. Right now it's in the hands of one person, and I don't think that's the right thing either. And so as this moves forward, if we require a unanimous vote on these, it very likely is that we'll be stuck in the same boat we are right now with nothing being able to be done unless it's incredibly one way or another. There's an inherent amount of risk, not just political risk, but also inherent risk with the parolee if something were to happen and that kind of thing that has to be taken into account and into effect here. So it, I would recommend a no vote. I don't know if Commissioner Schnell has anything he'd like to add on this, Chair.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Tapke covered it well. You know, right now it's a single person, it's a single person decision. This does open it up. The background stuff is there, and it addresses issues of shifts in ideology or shifts in case facts that can be difficult. So I do think, you know, making this unanimous decision does not really reflect. And I would just point out that in terms of comparing it to a jury deliberation, this is not, this is a discretionary decision granted to, right now, to the commissioner by the legislature as a matter of policy.
Further discussion to the A5. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just, as I think, and you know, the unanimity for jury decisions is because, you know, we've decided as a society that it's better to have multiple guilty people go free than have one innocent. We just really have this presumption of innocence that's so strong. In this situation, I'll just note that there's such a, that all the political pressures are, they all go in one direction. There's no reward for having somebody who does well in their life and gets and comes out and et cetera. Really all the sort of the political danger is all in one direction. And it seems to me that that a majority vote recognizes that and allows folks to make the right decision. So I would urge a no vote as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion to the A5? And I'll call on you last. If anybody else have any comments? All right. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So Representative Tabke, you mentioned inherent risk in having a unanimous vote have to proceed for the indeterminate sentencing board to find that they should release somebody. I think that there's inherent risk in not allowing that. If we have a snowstorm like today and members of the board can't make it, but three could, and now they're determining, two of them get to determine whether a potentially very dangerous felon can be released back into society, based, like you said, off of political whims, as the commissioner stated, this board can change. That's risky too. And I think that this amendment just simply addresses that, and that's why I would urge members' support.
All right. All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The A5 amendment is not adopted. Okay. Now we will move on to, well, I'll just note that A1 and the A2 were based on before the DE was available, so I assume that A1 and A2 are withdrawn. They're the same thing. Yeah, I'm seeing some head nods. So, yes, so you don't have to worry about the A1 and the A2. And now we will move on to the DE1 amendment, and we'll take another vote on that. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. It's like Groundhog's Day. Over and over again. Okay, now we can move on to discussion of the bill as amended. Member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just note to Commissioner Schnell, it's noteworthy to have a public official in any capacity come forward and ask to have their power limited or dispersed. And if memory serves, this isn't the first time you've done that. So again, that's remarkable and I appreciate it. I think the core idea here of getting more voices involved in these monumental decisions as opposed to one is a good idea. I think the concern expressed in the amendments that were offered, certainly the one regarding having the board composed of former judges, is that this doesn't turn into a political instrument. And politics has been brought up in the course of the discussion of this bill a couple of times, that presumably, and I can be corrected if I'm wrong, presumably this is trying to address a concern about political inertia going in one direction, and that goal is to try to negate that to some extent. And my concern is that with the board being composed by a bunch of gubernatorial appointees who only need to make decisions by a majority as opposed to unanimously, that the pendulum might be swinging too far in the other direction. And so that's my hang up with this bill. I think we could get it to a point where I would be able to say without reservation that it's a good idea. I'm just not there right now. Thank you.
Further discussion? Commissioner Schnell, go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I could just respond, I do appreciate the fact that this really is the spirit of shared governance. And I think that's what brought this forward, of wanting to make sure that there was an attempt at shared governance in really critical public safety decisions. At the same time, I think, as we look at this issue, we want to be in a place where there is a level of transparency and fairness. There can be really individualized factors of even in looking at a case where, certain types of offense characteristics might have really create personal challenges for one of those board members, but the four others may look at this through a correctional lens. And I want to be really clear about that. That's what this is about. It's a correctional lens. I can tell you that I take the decision around parole very seriously. The number of cases that we've seen come forward have increased, not necessarily because of more life sentences from the loss of life cases, but the legislature in 2005 added certain sex offenses that can now be also sentenced to life sentences, and they have the possibility of parole after 15 years. We're seeing these numbers go up. They're very challenging, and I can just say this, no one wants to be wrong, and I certainly am in that chair. I do not want to be wrong about these decisions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I had a question, and really came up with Representative Ingen's A5 amendment and something he mentioned as, like the snowstorm and what happens. And so I'm just curious for you, what happens currently? I mean, I know you have these hearings. If there's a big weather event or some other reason why you can't have it, or if you know that a number of members of this board are going to be gone for a particular reason, I'm assuming that you just will reschedule, but could you speak to that, please, Commissioner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we right now, most of these hearings take place, we're on video phone with them at the correctional facilities. We can have people dial in from different locations, but certainly we would want to make sure that the board members would be there. And I would just point out that really prior to 1980, that Minnesota did have a parole board who made these decisions. And in 1980, after sentencing guidelines went into effect, this really became the function of the commissioner. So this is not unusual, and it certainly is part of our state's history. And so we would make sure that people are there. We also, generally the day looks like in the mornings, we meet with victims, surviving family members in these cases. That can be done either in person or via video calls. And then in the afternoons, we hold the parole hearings.
Thank you. So it sounds like we have more flexibility now with the remote options in video and phone than probably existed.
Yes.
Before 1980.
Much more.
Yeah. Further member discussion? Closing comments, Representative Tabby.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller and members and Commissioner Schnell, for working through this bill. I think it's a really good, a very good governance type of bill. I think it's something that will help distribute some power, as Representative Hudson was talking about. But I also want to address really quickly the my goal and why I wanted to take this is not I don't think that once, whether it's a Democratic or a Republican governor and appointing the board, I'm not so much worried about the politics of the board because it is there are good people who will do good work moving forward. And I think that what we need to make sure to recognize is this will, by having a board, this will reduce the politicization of the decisions that are made by the parole boards. It won't fall on a single person as to why decisions are made or how they're made and things. So I very much hope that as if there's other things that we can do to help make this language better, I'm more than willing to work on people with people until we get there. So thank you, Chair Mueller.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1321 as amended. And if the two of you want to just stay put, because now we've got House File 1462. And Representative Tabke, I believe your motion is that House File 1462 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
That is my motion, Chair.
And thankfully, there are no amendments this time for me to mess up. Go ahead and tell us about House File 1462, Representative Tabke.
Thank you so much. So House File 1462 is a really good utilization of state resources. I'm excited to bring this one forward because we have been, as everyone knows, seeing increases in mental health issues. And what happens, one thing that's happening today is our jails are getting more mental health, more folks in the jail suffering from mental health, from the increasing criminalization of mental health crises and issues around those topics. And so with this, what this bill will do is utilize as a pilot program Department of Corrections resources so that jails can send folks to up to five folks to the mental health unit that Department of Corrections has. And so it will help all of our counties, it will help all of our sheriffs and jails make sure that we are taking care of people with mental health in the right manners, and also relieving folks who are relieving jails of folks who are suffering major mental health crises, and they could be dangerous to everyone involved. And so this is a much better place for them to be. And so again, this is a pilot project to see how this would all work. I look for folks' support, and I'm sure that Commissioner Schnell has more to add to that.
Thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner Schnell, please introduce yourself again.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Paul Schnell, Commissioner, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this. Over the past several years, the DOC has heard from sheriffs and county jails across Minnesota who are facing, as you know, significant challenges finding mental treatment for those incarcerated individuals who have serious and persistent mental illnesses. In working with the Sheriff's Association, the Department of Corrections developed a proposal to provide an avenue to study how the state could partner. The bill is simple. It really creates a pilot program that would allow for counties to contract to place people in the DOC for treatment and housing of those who would normally be in their county facilities. These folks would have to meet that threshold of having a serious and persistent mental illness. Under the pilot, these inmates would be transferred from the county jails to the secure mental health unit at the DOC's Oak Park Heights Correctional Facility. The pilot would be limited to five individuals, as Representative Tapke pointed out. While they're there, they would be able to access the full range of psychiatric services, medication services. We have a 24/7 staff mental health unit there that can serve up to 40 people at any given time. That population has been largely used for those people in the DOC system who are experiencing acute mental health issues. So there is oftentimes a significant number of beds available there. We do have the capacity to provide these services, and under the language, it would be budget neutral for the state, as the county would pay a per diem for and any additional expenses, which they would already bear if they were in the county jail for those services. The Department of Human Services, the DOC's health services and mental health staff, the Sheriff's Association, and NAMI would be involved in overseeing the program. The pilot is limited, and a report would be due to the legislature that outlines the program, its challenges, and any recommendations going forward. I just want to say thank you, Representative Tapke, for carrying the bill and for helping us really work to try and find even a small solution to a big problem that our state faces around having services for people in the system who suffer from serious and persistent mental illnesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I understand there's someone from the Sheriff's Association here who'd like to testify as well. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Habel. I'm the sheriff in Renville County. I also serve on the executive committee, and I chair or co-chair the Jail Policy and Oversight Committee at the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. It's truly my honor to be in front of you today to testify in support of this bill. As you know, the jails across Minnesota have really become warehouses for our mentally ill. Just like we would expect our inmates to be treated for physical ailments and injuries, those inmates deserve help and treatment for their mental illnesses as well. And unfortunately, in county jails, we just don't have the resources to be able to provide that. What's more, these inmates are incredibly taxing on our corrections officers today. Sometimes these inmates demand literally one-on-one treatment with our, or one-on-one time with our corrections officers, and demand their undivided attention. So as an example, I'd like to share just a quick story with you this morning. It's about a young lady of 25 years old. We'll call her Jane. To look at Jane, you wouldn't think that she struggled with mental illness at all. However, Jane had a really long mental health history. So at about 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, there was a custodian at one of our Catholic churches who went to the church to shut the lights off and lock the doors for the day. And once he was inside, he noticed that the sanctuary in this beautiful church had been destroyed, really. Their beautiful statues had been knocked down and broken. There was glass everywhere. Everything was in disarray. There was a pile in the aisle going up to the altar, carpeted floors. There was a pile of hymnals and Bibles and books and carpet and so forth, all in a pile that had attempted to be burned. And in the front of the church, there was a young lady. It was Jane. And she was ripping up more carpet, trying to pile this up to start a huge fire. So there's more to this story, but eventually Jane landed in our county jail. And so once she's there, she continued to display these super bizarre behaviors. She demanded, as an example, the number to the White House so that she could call her staff and talk with them. She was seeing things that really didn't exist. She was hearing voices that weren't real. Her days consisted mostly of talking to herself, screaming, and pushing that button, summoning the corrections officers. All day, every day. At some point, she began to violently bang on her cell and bang on her cell door and was screaming and crying and literally begging to be taken to a hospital so that the doctor could fix her head. This poor lady was crying out, and there wasn't much that we could do for her. At one point, she attempted to hurt herself. She attempted to kill herself. She had wrestled a key away from one of our corrections officers. She plugged her toilet with the very clothes she was wearing and tried to flood her cell to wash these demons out of her cell. She was incredibly mentally ill. Her story goes on and on. She so badly needed mental health treatment, but she couldn't get it in our facility. We just don't have those resources. We have corrections officers. Those are people with oftentimes just a high school education, and they're tasked with taking care of and being responsible for maybe the most complex humans on the planet. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this happened in a medium-sized jail. Imagine, if you will, imagine if this happened in one of many counties that don't have dedicated corrections officers. So many counties today, tiny little counties, have dispatcher jailers. Most of the time, it's one person who's in charge of running the 911 dispatch center, answering those 911 calls, dispatching emergency services, and also caring for the inmates. There's virtually no way that they could care for an inmate like Jane. So Jane's story is just one of so many across the state. Our county jails continue to be plagued with this problem. and they're just not the correct place for these inmates. So I know that none of us has the end-all, be-all, solve-all solution to this problem. However, this bill creates some hope. It's a pilot program to explore whether or not counties can partner with Commissioner Schnell's team and provide some much, much needed resources. It's a step in the right direction. It's a pilot program, so if it fails, in my opinion, we're out nothing. If it succeeds, man, it could be really the start of something much, much bigger. And if that's the case, as Commissioner Schnell mentioned, everybody benefits, not the least of which is our inmates suffering from mental illness. So I think I've used my time. I absolutely appreciate the honor, or the opportunity, rather, to be here before you today, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thanks, Sheriff. Thanks for your testimony. And before I call on other members of the public, too, I'll just say there's so much that we do in this committee, the Public Safety Committee, that we know there are a lot more things that impact public safety. And so as you're telling your story, yes, of course, we need Jane to have services, but how do we prevent Jane from even getting into that system in the first place? And those things are outside the things that we hear in this committee, just speaking to the need for mental health services and substance abuse treatment, and all of those things to help prevent people from even coming into the criminal justice system in the first place are also so important. It's just not something that we always hear about in this committee. So just wanted to take a minute to acknowledge that. Are there members of the public who wish to testify? Come on down. I see you. I can barely see you behind the wall here. I know. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name's Amanda Biggins. I am a correctional officer at Rush City for about 10 years now. Rush City Prison, excuse me. I do like the bill. I think it has great guts in it, although it is very frustrating on our end. I come from Rush City. That's called the Gladiator School. We have a lot of mentally ill people there that we can't even take care of. Like the sheriff was saying earlier, I have spent hours talking a guy out of hanging himself in his cell. I have many other officers, you know, have done a lot of stuff like that as well. And so I just think it would be nice if we could maybe concentrate on sending help towards the prisons and helping us, because we have so many people that need to go to that mental health unit. We have so many people, like I said, I talked 2 hours, I had to talk to a guy out of hanging himself, and that sucks, because you can tell he has voices in his head, we need to get these people help. And I know there's not, like you said, a great way to make this work yet. There's always whatever, but I'm not great at talking, I'm sorry. But I really think that we need to get more help in our facilities before we allot to other people. So that's all I had to say.
Thank you, and you did a great job.
Thanks.
So thank you so much for being here. Your testimony was important. We appreciate it. Any other members of the public? Yep, come on down. If you are another public member and you're thinking you wanna testify, we have time, so you can just kind of make your way down. That would be helpful. Oh, sorry, they were just letting her back into her row, into her seat behind the wall over here. So I'm not seeing anybody else. I do have a question, and Commissioner, if you want to come back to the table as well. I'm not seeing a fiscal note, so it's my understanding that this is policy only and it doesn't have a cost. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Because the cost would be borne by the county who would be sending that person to us, which is right now they would be responsible for procuring those services in their community. For instance, if the sheriff wanted to have Jane seen by a psychiatrist, they would have to contract or have somebody come in and meet those needs. This would simply bring them to the unit, would allow the psychiatrists and the mental health team there, is staffed by mental health nurses around the clock as well, but that they would just be built into a per diem that we would contract with the counties to provide.
Great, thank you. We can move on to member discussion. Representative Becker Finn.
Yeah, and can you, before I share my comments and questions, wondering if you can just clarify what the motion was, where this is going next?
We're laying this over.
Okay, great.
No, sorry, excuse me. Sorry, General Register.
Okay, we were all wrong over here. I think this is great. One thing though that I, as I was, you know, listening and reading through, I think a perspective that's missing are the folks who currently do the mental health work out in the community now. So for folks who aren't familiar, serious and persistent mental illness is defined in statute. I couldn't find it real quickly, but I mean, these are folks with personality level disorders, schizophrenia, very serious, not the kind of thing where like you go to treatment for 2 months and you're fine. You know, it's an ongoing thing that people are dealing with. And right now, there is this interplay with our civil system because some of these people go in and out of being on mental health holds and other civil mechanisms that come into play. And, you know, there is this requirement that we hold folks in the least restrictive environment if they're you know, fall under that framework. And there is sort of that back and forth. You know, we've had discussions about that, you know, with, you know, even some other incidents that have happened where people kind of the interplay back and forth between the systems. You know, we do have, so folks are familiar, ERTS facilities, so intensive residential treatment services. There are even forensic ERTS. There are more getting to be more and more of those. So those are mental health facilities that focus on folks with criminal history and criminal issues as well. And I think the perspective of the folks doing that work in particular, because an ERTS is usually 90 to 120 days, so it's sort of the same kind of work that we're talking about, the same kind of population, that I think having that perspective, I don't know that we need to amend the bill, but just as it moves forward, or maybe even adding that to the list, starting on 1.18, you know, I see we've got the sheriff's great, Department of Human Services, great, NAMI. Folks don't always realize this, but NAMI advocates for people with mental illness and their families, but not for the people who do the work. And so I think having more perspective from licensed mental health professionals who are actually actively doing this work right now could be really informative and might be a different perspective than the folks who are currently working within DOC would have. So I wanted to bring that up. You know, I think it's funny because it's like this summary is one page, and this is such a serious issue, and it's so complicated because of that civil criminal interplay. And I think that perspective could be really helpful in making sure this is effective. So I guess I don't know if I have a question, maybe a comment from Representative Tabke, but I think adding that perspective could be really helpful. Again. Because a lot of times they leave jail to go to an ERTS, and then they go to an ERTS, and then they decomp or something happens, and then they call the police, and then the police don't want to transport them because that's also like a, you know, we understand, and sometimes they don't even call the police because they don't want to bring in someone with a gun into the, you know, it's a very complicated thing, but I think the perspective of those folks giving them the treatment out in the community right now might be super helpful. So just throwing that out there. Sorry, I didn't think of it sooner when I was prepping for committee.
Yeah. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and Representative Eckervin. So yeah, I very much agree with what you're saying and exactly where you're at. And so this is the goal of this is to have folks who have to be in jail but aren't, that a jail may not have the services that are necessary for those folks that are in there. So a judge may have committed them at pretrial, like wherever that may be before they're in the Department of Corrections system. And so I am very willing to add language in there to help with that, and we'll work on that before we go to the floor with it. So I appreciate that. But it's like the commissioner was telling me a story how there was someone in jail on I believe it was northern Minnesota, and it was someone who had to be there but was breaking unbreakable windows and things like that and was having serious mental crises, and it just was not the right place for that person to be. And so this would be an outlet and kind of a relief valve for folks who need additional assistance.
Representative Beckerfin. And I'll just say my mom used to be the jail nurse in the Beltrami County Jail, so totally understand, especially in our smaller rural communities, that they just don't, you know, it was her and one other person who took turns, and they were not trained to handle anything of that level, so totally understand, and I think this is a good thing, and hopefully we'll see success with it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
just even this past weekend, I got a phone call to check on someone with my old police department that was having a mental health crisis, and they did bring law enforcement into it, and then how it all went about. It went above and beyond trying to take them to the hospital and then home and make sure they're safe. But I've heard this from the Sheriff's Association. I've seen it when I worked. Is this a couple questions? Is this pre or post commitment after they've seen a judge?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, and I'll let Commissioner Schnell answer because he'll get it. But it both.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Woody, they're by judicial order. It could be pretrial.
Yeah.
The case that the Representative Tapke was referencing was, it was a pretrial case. It was pending. The needs were far, far greater than they could access, even in the community, and some really high risk and some with this particular person. And ultimately, when they were transferred to the Department of Corrections, a Jarvis order had to be obtained in order to force medication in that case, just because of the acuity of the crisis. And so that's what this unit can specialize in. That really becomes challenging at the county jail level.
Representative Woody.
And thank you, because I know this is much needed. So on a pre or post commitment, isn't it 48 hours they have to leave the facility? And what we're finding is there's a backlog at the other facilities. So they're holding them for over 2 weeks or longer, putting a lot of pressure on our county jails. And we've also seen recently that the county jails numbers are higher and not manageable. So is this a way to relieve some of that pressure? I do like the resources. I guess once you leave the jail, whose responsibility is it? Does it fall on the DOCs or does it stay on the county? And then my last question, I really appreciate the sheriff's story. How do we help Jane in this? Because Oak Park Heights is all males. Do we have a facility to help Jane? Thank you. I threw a few out there.
All right, Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Chair Mohler and Representative Woody. So the first is 48-hour rule. This came to me because I'm working on that issue and we're trying to get some. So if you're interested in working on that, I could use all the help I can get. So we are working through that. And so this is, like I said, it's kind of a relief valve for that because there are a lot of folks who are sitting in jail for months who need assistance and need help, but beds simply aren't available for that. So we're working through that, and I'll let Commissioner Schnell take the other questions.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Woody, we can move women here. There is the ability to separate by sight and sound at Oak Park Heights, which is really the requirement. So we have and we can do that in those kind of rare situations. You know, the goal here is to stabilize. I think ultimately, if a court determined that, you know, that person could be moved on a pretrial basis to an IRTS facility would be ideal. But, you know, right now I think this number is really small. So it's not going to take a tremendous amount of relief off of the counties. We do believe that in the long haul, you know, we hope that we can achieve some positive outcomes here. And if we do that, we may be coming back then with the Sheriff's Association, with other partners here, to see if there could be expanded use of this, which may then take some of the pressure off the counties.
Anything further, Representative
Woody? No, just thank you for bringing this forward. It's the sheriffs need it, and the mental health piece is so it's a huge issue out in our society. So thank you. I know it. Even the correction deputy, law enforcement wears so many hats, and this is a tough one. So thank you for finding the resources.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to actually build on your somewhat tangential comment before, because this feels so important to me as I was thinking this through. You know, you commented about the need for mental health services more broadly, and I've been noticing and thinking for a while now. In my committee, we have shelter-linked mental health grants. For young people in shelter, there are school-linked mental health grants. There are juvenile justice mental health grants. I've had a lot of conversation with Vice Chair Feist about this. We're now talking about county jail, DOC, and I just really kind of want to do a shout to the heavens and to members of this committee and people in the room and anybody watching, right? that it should be, it should not matter where you are. We should be, there should be mental health services provided. You shouldn't have to be in shelter or be in a jail. We know all the negative aspects associated with that. So just kind of, I know, strange place in public safety, but universal health care that actually treats mental health the same as physical health seems like a major public safety issue. Just shouting that out. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Tapke and Commissioner Schnell, for this. I wanted to ask, focus a little bit more on the cost of the program, simply because as I was reading through the bill, I understand that this is for the counties would have to, you know, get in contract with DOC, and they'd have to pay for this that way, and that cost is already something they would have to do anyway. I want to know, what does that look like, honestly? I just wanted to know what this, first of all, is the treatment already something that's established at Oak Heights, that, or is this something we're going to have to create since this is a new pilot project? And is that going to incur some extra costs? Is there something that's already established, or are we going to have to do something? And I do have a follow-up, please.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Chair Mullen and Representative Mueller. This is a fully staffed and set up facility already. So it's existing, it's there, it's current state assets that we can, this bill will help us better utilize at that point.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. And then my last question would be, I saw this is a pilot program that is, you know, for the counties that, you know, want to participate in this. Do we have a certain ability to be able to ensure that we have at least some representation in Greater Minnesota in this? I mean, Greater Minnesota is the place where it's going to bankrupt the counties the most. I, coming from Mower, speak with my sheriff, who talks very passionately about this, and so I just want to make sure that, you know, if we're going to do this, and I know it's a very small pilot, that it's going to be something that's going to be the most, you know, impactful. Thank you.
Representative Pecky.
Thank you, Chair Mullen, Representative Mueller. Yeah, that's, I think that this is a pilot project and this is moving forward, we'll learn exactly where the needs are, but the base assumption right now is that the vast majority of the folks coming will be from Greater Minnesota, because a lot of the metro jails have the ability to handle folks of that are experiencing these issues at this time. And so that's the assumption, but we'll see who utilizes it as we go through the pilot program. So that's what it's for.
Great. And we have three members who have questions or comments, so I'm going to call on them, and then we're going to go ahead and move to a vote on the bill so we can get to our final bill for the day. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Tapke. Just a real quick oversight to talk to Representative Mueller's situation on this. It will be much cheaper to do this in the prisons or in the incarcerated areas. You transport one of these patients, you got an ambulance charge, you got an ER charge, you have security charges to keep them because they're incarcerated, so the deputy's got to come with them. Tons of costs there. If we could treat them there, it's going to be much better, and also it's going to have a better outcome, and we know this through our embedded social workers with our police officers. In my communities alone, we're seeing that we're not transporting these patients to the hospital. They're getting the care they need, they're putting in the system, and we don't have to move them, and we're saving the system a lot of money, and I hope to expand on that. But the downside of that, and that brings me to this next question, is our lack of social workers, because that's usually who this falls to. I think we're developing a clinical practice here with the criminal aspect or the possible violation of the law, and also the mental health issues here, because it really comes into a specialized area, and I think we have to be open to a committee to look at different levels of practitioners or new practitioners that we could put with this, because it definitely is. I've met many of these people, and it's definitely a specialty that they're engaged with. So thank you for bringing this bill. I look forward to seeing it grow, and I think this we're onto something here.
Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Tapke, I love this idea. I think right now we have a proclivity to treat mental health as if it's something that should be simply put away rather than actually examined, treated, cared for adequately. So thank you for that. My question really just comes down to, it's a volunteer program, so it sounds like the individual who's going to be going to treatment has to volunteer. Is that correct?
Representative Tapke.
Chair Mullen, Representative Engen, this is the county volunteering someone to go there.
Okay, that was my.
I'd prefer to be there. No, that's not what this is. This is the county can't handle the person for whatever reasons, and then they are taken there non-voluntarily.
Representative Engen.
Okay, that was really my only question. That we want to make sure that the folks who are going there, the acuity of care, that it fits the needs. So that's just something to think about, and I'd like to see how this turns out in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Botney.
Very quick question. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Commissioner Snell, just a question that I have based on the standpoint, we're going to take someone who may be being held at a county jail on a very minor charge, and they haven't even, if it's pre-conviction, they might not even been found guilty of that charge, and now we're going to put them in the maximum security prison in the state, and you addressed it briefly with the separation by sight and sound. I'm just, and I understand that that's where the mental health unit currently is, but do we have any concerns about placing someone pre-sentence in our maximum security prison?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Lee Devotny, no, I think what this really does is that allows us, gives us the authority to do that on a pretrial basis. Again, this is a service focus. It's not so much, you know, it's not as much security focused. That unit, Oak Park Heights, does both, serves as like we have almost an intensive care level medical unit there as well. So when people come out of our out of hospitals after surgery, they go there as opposed to being in a local hospital. And this unit is similar situated. It's built into that unit. It has all these services there. It is, I think to Chair Becker-Finn's comment earlier, we want people in the least restrictive environment possible. And in these cases, you know, the court has determined, albeit on a pretrial basis, that they require exceptional services and are not therefore able to be released into the community. And in those circumstances where that mental health unit at Oak Park Heights is able to meet that person's needs, that's when this would be, would be implemented. We do believe that it is an appropriate use of resources. It serves people who are in an acute crisis. They may be there for, generally up to 180 days, 6 months could be that long. There would be some issues around, transporting that person back and forth to the county. But really, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that people get what they need, and that's what this is about.
Representative Devani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Commissioner Snell, for addressing that. And as a person who spent more hours than I cared to for work locked in the Hennepin County Medical Center psych ward, I'd like to just say I'd like to visit that unit and really see the work they do and have the assurance from you that it's separated by sight and sound, because the sound can be the worst. So, thank you.
Commissioner Snell.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Knott. You are always invited, and I would invite all the members of the committee to visit that facility and that unit in particular and see what the work that gets done there.
Any closing remarks, Representative Tapke?
Thank you very much for the great discussion about this bill, and as we are continuing to do work, we need to make sure that we're focusing on decriminalizing mental health and making sure that we are giving people the treatments and services that people need before they get to a point for needing a facility like this. So thank you very much for the discussion, and look forward to this moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Tapke renews the motion that House File 1462 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, sir.
All right, members, our last bill on the calendar our last bill on the agenda is House File 3. It's a Representative Greenman bill. I will move that House File 3 be re-referred to the Committee on Human Services. There are no amendments, and this is a bill that's going to lots of different committees, and we'll be limiting our discussion today to those that pertain to public safety. Representative Greenman, welcome to the committee, and please describe your bill for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for clarification, it's going to Human Services Finance.
Yes, thank you. We didn't. All right, I'll just make it very clear that the motion is that House File 3 be re-referred to the Committee on Human Services Finance. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, and good morning. I'm really grateful to be here to present House File 3, the Democracy for the People Act, which defends and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of inclusive voter participation, sound elections administration, and grassroots people-powered democracy. We have heard and discussed the full bill in elections, and this has a lot of stops, so I will keep my remarks confined to the part of the bill under the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee, which is the criminal penalties related to the prohibition of voter intimidation and deceptive practices. The bill's provisions responds to the rising climate of risks and threats and disinformation that we've seen over the last few years. We have heard from national law enforcement folks, the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center, that they've identified heightened threats and disruptions targeting our elections in both 2020 and 2022. In 2020 in Minnesota, we saw it with a private firm, Atlas Aegis, reportedly recruiting armed security contractors to come to Minnesota to be outside of polling places in Minneapolis. In that case, the quick intervention of the Attorney General's Office and the Secretary of State were able to prevent that intimidating conduct. But those threats, that intimidation of voters, has been on the rise across the country since then. In 2022, there's been a concerning increase of intimidation in states across the country. In Arizona, in 2022, we saw extremist groups recruiting folks to monitor drop boxes and voters using those drop boxes. In Colorado, we saw a group organize volunteers to go door-to-door in search of voter fraud. 10,000 voters got their doors knocked on in a pretty intimidating way. We've seen non-governmental groups across the country, including in Minnesota, organize their own poll worker training, where instructions to challenge and question elections practices were included. We're grateful that here in Minnesota, to our knowledge, voters have not yet faced that same threats that we've seen in Arizona, in Colorado, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Georgia, in Florida, and a set of states. But unfortunately, this problem is only growing and emerging, and we are, as we head into another contested election in 2024, now is the time to act. This bill is our opportunity to draw a clear line of what's permissible and show that the conduct, threats, interference, intimidation, deceptive practices is unacceptable. This bill draws that clear line about the protections and safeguard of voters in a few ways. It prohibits intimidating a voter with the intent to compel a person to register or abstain from registering, to vote or to not vote, and to vote for a specific candidate or not a specific candidate. It prohibits intentional deceptive practices intended to impede a voter from exercising the right to vote, and it prohibits intentional efforts to interfere with or to prevent another person from voting. It gives law enforcement clear lines and tools they need to fight these deceptive practices and acts of disinformation and intimidation, and makes the violations of the sections a gross misdemeanor in line with other violations of 211B. And with that, Madam Chair, I forgo testifiers so that we would have time for discussion, and I will turn it back over to you.
All right, thank you. Before we get to member discussion, are there any members of the public who wish to testify? I am not seeing any. And again, we are limiting our discussion to Article 2, Section 2. Any member discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about the breadth of what can be considered intimidation and also our means of determining whether or not it has occurred. I mean, there's language in here referencing the Attorney General's ability to bring a civil action, stating that the moving party does not need to show that the actor intended to cause the victim to feel intimidated. So we're taking intention out of it. As you listed examples of intimidation included in there, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it sounded like you were talking about canvassing of folks after an election to ask them about election issues or voting behavior, comparing and contrasting with records from the Secretary of State. I see you shaking your head, so go ahead and address that.
Yeah, Representative Greenman.
Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, so I'll just first sort of clarify. The criminal provisions of this can only be enforced. The Attorney General does not have enforcement authority in the criminal provisions. This leaves it where a normal criminal enforcement provision is, which is the county attorneys, and in the case of gross misdemeanors, likely the city attorneys as well. And as required by law, the criminal provisions have clear mens rea requirements. And so when we talk about the criminal provisions, there is intentionality that is required to be proven. In the Colorado example, I believe that case was before the election. They were canvassing folks. That's why I was nodding my head. And I'm happy to provide, that was in a Brennan Center report where they did some look at the 2020 election. I think that as we talk about the paper trying to prevent, as the bill is clear, it is to vote or not to vote, to register or not to vote. I think questions about what happens after the election we could talk about, but my example was really about a behavior that might prevent people or intimidate people from going and exercising their right to vote before an election.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that clarification. That's a relief. And, you know, certainly there are, I've heard stories of folks who put out information, when we get to the misinformation aspect of this, that intentionally misinforms about hours that polls are open and things of that nature. 100%, that's something that we should not allow and should have corrective action for. My concern is that if we're not deeply specific about what constitutes both intimidation and misinformation, this could very quickly become a tool used for political ends to curtail speech that whatever side happens to be in executive control just doesn't like, and can categorize as intimidation, not based upon any demonstration of intent, but based upon a seemingly plausible argument that a reasonable person would feel intimidated by it. So that's my piece. Appreciate you letting me make it.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. And I think that's why, if you look at the language of the deceptive practices piece, you know, it's within 60 days of the election. It includes intent to impede and that the person knows it to be materially false. I think that I share with you, don't want to get close to the First Amendment. And also, when we think about deceptive practices, we really are looking for the cases where people are putting out information. We've heard of robocalls telling people when the election, polling places have been canceled. And under this law, law enforcement would have to show, in the criminal context, that they knew that to be materially false. And I was a public defender, so I spent a lot of time trying to poke holes in prosecutors' cases. That is something that's pretty hard to prove if you don't have the evidence. And so I think that this bill does, lots of it follows the federal approach, and some of it follows our current law in other places to make sure that we strike that right balance. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. I really appreciate those questions. As I said, I think one of the benefits of doing this and doing this now is that it will provide it'll provide law enforcement, it'll provide our election workers or our election administrators very clear rules about what is and is not permitted. Every election cycle, the Secretary of State works with our elections administrators. They're encouraged to coordinate with law enforcement to make sure folks know what is and is not permitted, and this will provide really clear lines. So I would ask you for support.
And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3 be re-referred to the Committee on Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right, thank you so much, Representative Freeman. That was our last bill on the agenda. I'll just note that due to the expected snow event, as you all know, we will not be here on Thursday. So our committee hearing that was scheduled for Thursday won't be happening. We'll be awaiting to see if we'll get a new time for committee, but obviously we'll be hearing those bills. Just stay tuned as to when that will be. And of course, members from the public can continue to watch our page on the website to see where those bills get scheduled. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.